Exactly 60 years ago, in 2 days from now, on August 19, 1953, the CIA carried out Operation Ajax. It was the code name for the first coup d'etat ever performed by the United States to oust a democratically elected government thousands of miles overseas. I'm Sahar Hakju, and you're watching Aperture. The 1953 CIA coup in Iran, ousting the country's elected and very popular Prime Minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, ushered in a quarter century of brutal rule under the second Pahlavi Shah and laid the foundation for America's mindset that coups can be implemented as a useful and effective tool in foreign policy. Today's documentary, American Coup, gives a vivid account of the whys and wherefores of the American belligerent interference in Iran's internal affairs and what ensued.
In August of 1953, Iran had a democratic government. Its parliament and prime minister, the popular Mohammad Mossadegh, had nationalized the oil industry to control the country's chief asset. Then, the CIA intervened.
I am honored to be in the timeless city of Cairo. We meet at a time of great tension between the United States and Muslims around the world. Tension rooted in historical forces that go beyond any current policy debate. For many years, Iran has defined itself in part by its opposition to my country. And there is, in fact, a tumultuous history between us. In the middle of the Cold War, the United States played a role in the overthrow of a democratically elected Iranian government. This history is well known.
I have never heard anything about the CIA, especially in 1953.
I don't know anything about it.
I'm sorry, I don't know anything about that.
I have no knowledge of that whatsoever.
Something I've never heard of, never known anything about.
I have no clue.
Can you repeat that?
Well, I wasn't born in 1953, so I've never heard of the coup.
That was a little bit before my time.
After the Eisenhower administration made its decision to overthrow Mossadegh, Alan Dulles selected Kermit Roosevelt to carry out the coup. At the beginning of August 1953, Kermit Roosevelt arrived in Tehran and began this covert operation. It's really a fascinating operation to study because it answers this odd question: how do you overthrow a government?
Former Premier Mossadegh's ruined house is a mute testimony to 3 days of bloody rioting culminating in a military coup.
Suppose you get sent to a country and you're told, overthrow the government. So what do you do on the first day? What do you do on the second day?
In the quick shift of power, Mossadegh was finally apprehended and awaits trial for treason. The Shah, who had fled to Rome, comes home, backed by General Zahedi, military strongman, who engineered his return to power. The general will now have a strong voice in the newly formed government, whose cabinet is seen here with Shah Pahlavi.
How do you overthrow a government? Many countries in the Middle East are what you might call fake countries or invented countries. They're countries that were created by outside powers, usually in the wake of World War I. And I think there's a temptation for people that aren't familiar with the region to see Iran in that category, but that's not true. Actually, the opposite is true. Iran, formerly known as Persia, is one of the world's oldest civilizations. At a time when Europeans were still living in caves and wearing animal skins, people in Persia were conducting experiments in astronomy and learning about mathematics and writing beautiful poetry. So this is a civilization that has a great deal of sense of its history, a sense of self-confidence, a sense of identity, and a sense of being rooted in the long course of world. This is not a country that just arrived and is trying to figure out who or what it is.
In 1908, the British discovered oil in Iran. Geologists soon learned that Iran sits on an ocean of oil. The British decided that they needed oil to run their cars, to power their navy, and to fuel their economy.
But Britain has no oil. When oil was discovered there, the British decided that they would like to control that entire resource. Soon after the discovery, this Anglo-Iranian oil company was formed, and it purchased the majority stake. And then the oil company arranged a concession with Iran. The entire stock of Iranian oil was the property of this British company, and all the rights to exploit oil in Iran belonged to this company.
Oil, of course, became very profitable from the 1920s onwards, and the way the division was abysmal. For instance, Iran was getting sometimes 16% of the profits, and so, and the profits were defined in such a way that it actually shortchanged Iran. Books were not open to the public, even to the Iranian government.
In 1951, Mohammad Mossadegh was chosen Prime Minister of Iran. Mossadegh was a tireless social reformer, fiercely nationalistic, and incorruptible. No account of the 20th century is complete without a chapter on him.
Mohammad Mossadegh was an outstanding politician, political figure in Iran for a long, long time. He had relatives who were part of the previous dynasty, the Qajar dynasty, and he was a prominent figure for a number of decades in Iran. Before he became prime minister in 1951, he was a vocal opponent of British control over Iran's oil industry and generally Britain's control over Iran as a country.
As Iran's vast petroleum reserves aroused nationalists following seizure by the Iranian government of the British-operated refineries and distribution facilities, demonstrations at the huge oil port of Abadan culminate in the tearing down of signs over company offices and the raising of the Iranian flag over the installations.
Mossadegh was a fascinating figure. He must be one of the towering figures in the 20th century history of the developing world. Bear in mind that when he emerged, there had never been a figure from a poor country who had risen up in such a visible way to challenge the masters of the universe. Nobody from a poor country had ever stood up and said, we own this resource. It belongs to us. It doesn't matter what companies you've imposed on us or what agreements you've imposed on us. All of that was unjust. We have this resource and we are miserably poor. We need the money from this resource and we insist on having it.
He is very much interested in national sovereignty. But there's something more than that. He's not just a national leader. He was very sincerely committed to the notion of liberal democracy.
Time magazine made Mohammad Mossadegh its Man of the Year for 1951. They chose him over Douglas MacArthur, Harry Truman, Winston Churchill, and a number of other towering world figures. And they were right. He was the most important person in the world at that time. So people in Iran began challenging Anglo-Iranian Oil Company and saying, you've got to change your contract with us and give us 50%. And you keep 50%, not keep 90% or more, whatever it was. No one ever knew, since Iranians were never allowed to audit the books. The Anglo-Iranian Oil Company refused. They would not concede an inch. They were quite pig-headed. I think they were still maybe caught in the colonial mentality of the past and thought that the idea that some poor country could try to pressure them or dictate terms to them was unthinkable.
The important thing is who actually controls oil production. Because if you control oil production, then you can decide whether you're going to increase it or lower it. And that then determines, of course, price. What Mossadegh was doing was threatening that, because by nationalizing, he was saying, AIOC is not going to be in charge of production. Iran will be in charge. We can decide how much to produce, who to sell it to, and that could influence the market. So that's where it became the threat.
The ability of a foreign company to control oil in the Middle East was also important, not just for the British, but also in the Americans' eyes. They didn't want other countries in the Middle East to begin thinking that all you have to do is make trouble and foreign companies are going to have to make concessions to you.
The pretense was that they were willing to compromise. But the Brits, from the right beginning, they didn't want to give up control. They started spending some money on, you know, parks, swimming pools and stuff. So by 51, they were saying the Iranians should be grateful to us because we built you swimming pools and stuff. Well, of course, a swimming pool might cost the oil company £2,000. What's that when, you know, profits are like £50 million a year or something like that?
They were treating them kind of like the way we treated black Americans in pre-Civil War South, or even post-Civil War South, when you put them in economic slavery instead of real slavery. And persisted even more adamantly in their desire to rape, pillage, and plunder Iran. The Persians had every reason to dislike the way the AIOC was treating them.
The British didn't really know how to deal with a situation like this. It was a new era for them, but they were still thinking in an older era. One of their first impulses was, well, we're going to send an army and we'll just invade Iran. Harry Truman in Washington got wind of this and he went crazy.
You got this situation where Harry Truman, I think, says, I'm not having any of this. This is imperialism. This is colonialism. We fought a damn war. Winston Churchill, when you come back to the helm of government, you can go to hell.
President Truman was increasingly concerned about the intensity of this argument between Iran and Britain. At one point, he sent a leading figure in the United States, Averell Harriman, who had been famous as governor of New York and had held a number of international positions, to Iran with instructions to negotiate with Mossadegh and see if he could get Mossadegh to make some kind of a compromise with the British.
I want to express to you my appreciation for your willingness to undertake this trip to Iran. It's a very important job that you have undertaken, and one which I think you can handle with satisfaction and success.
Poor Averell Harriman was shuttling back and forth between British and Iranian representatives trying to make a deal, and realized that neither side was willing to.
the British policy was to actually undermine Mossadegh initially by putting economic pressure. So one way of economic pressure was to try to close down the whole the oil industry, thinking that the Iranians wouldn't be able to run the oil industry. Actually, Iranians were able to run it.
They kept turning up the pressure, hoping that, as one official of the old British company said, when they need money, they will come crawling to us on their bellies.
So the next step was to have a blockade, so Iran couldn't sell its oil. And so whenever tankers from Italy or somewhere came to buy oil, the British would actually impound them. This way, the main source of revenue, of course, for Iran dried up, because Iran's main source of foreign exchange and revenue was, in fact, oil.
The British then decided they would take Mossadegh to international tribunals. The first thing Britain did was to submit a resolution to the United Nations Security Council, in which the Security Council would order Iran to give back the oil company. When Mossadegh heard about this, he decided to do something that no leader of any poor country had ever done. He would fly himself to New York, which wasn't so easy in those days, and personally present Iran's case to the Security Council. He made quite a splash in New York City. He went to visit the Liberty Bell, went to Washington, D.C. He was a very colorful figure. Something like your beloved but perhaps slightly eccentric favorite uncle. His speech at the Security Council was very potent. It was the first time that most people at the UN and most people in the world had ever heard the leader of a poor country explain a clash like this from the perspective of the poor country. We'd always been hearing it from the other perspective.
The United Nations once again confronts a grave problem as Premier Mohammad Mossadegh of Iran arrives with Secretary Trigvali at the Security Council to present his side of the explosive Iranian oil case. The ailing statesman electrifies the council as he denies the right of the United Nations to intervene in what he calls a purely internal matter. He accuses Britain of intimidation by a display of armed might after the nationalization of the oil industry. Sir Gladwin Jebb, Britain's representative, is an attentive listener to his arguments, as is America's Warren Austin. The issue could be peace or war.
After that debate, the Security Council did something that it had never done in the brief history of the UN, which was to refuse to pass a resolution that had been sponsored by one of the leading members of the Security Council, Britain. So the UN refused to order Mossadegh to give back the oil company. Then the British decided, we're going to take Mossadegh to the World Court in The Hague. And Mossadegh himself flew to The Hague.
Hearings before the International Court at The Hague failed to solve the difference, as Premier Mossadegh, with his parliament behind him, firmly pursued his nationalist course.
The same thing happened. He had a great impact, not just on public opinion, but on the judges there. And those judges also refused to order him to give back the oil company. So the British were running out of options. From their point of view, Iran had stolen something that belonged to Britain. It was seemed like an open and shut case. We had a contract with them. They gave us the right to all their oil. Now they want it back. But this is a contract. It cannot be violated. They signed it. The United Nations did not accept this argument. The World Court did not accept this argument. This was quite a shock for the British.
The British tried to oust Mossadegh by bribing members of Parliament. When Mossadegh got wind of the plot, he promptly kicked the Brits out of the country.
After the British embassy in Tehran was closed, the British were more or less out of options. They had tried everything from blockading ports to appeals to international bodies, threats, embargoes, everything. Now they didn't even have anyone in Iran. So they turned to the Americans.
Then, in November of 1952, the surge of excitement charged through the British Foreign Service. In Washington, a new president had been elected, Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Ike for president, Ike for president. You like Ike, I like Ike. Everybody likes Ike
for president.
Hang out the banner and beat the drum. We'll take Ike to Washington. We got to get where we are going. Travel day and night
for president.
Let Adelaide go the other way. We'll all go with Ike
for president.
You like Ike, I like Ike. Everybody likes Ike
for president.
Hang out the banner and beat the drum. We'll take Ike to Washington. We'll take Ike to Washington.
Now is the time for all good Americans to come to the aid of their country.
There was a fundamental disagreement between Truman and Eisenhower on the question of whether Mossadegh was the problem or the solution. Truman and his Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, had for some time been working fairly closely with Mossadegh. They had a fundamental sympathy towards Iran and its efforts to get itself out from under the influence of Great Britain. They became convinced that negotiations with Mossadegh were the way to go. Eisenhower and his group, on the other hand, although they didn't reach this conclusion right away, were much more disposed towards finding some other solution.
The British approach to the incoming Republican administration about overthrowing Mossadegh. John Foster Dulles, the new Secretary of State, had long railed against the dangers of communism. For much of his career, he had served as a top lawyer for large multinational corporations. His brother Alan became the new director of the CIA. It was the first and only time that siblings controlled both overt and covert sides of American foreign policy. It wasn't hard for the British to talk the brothers into overthrowing Mossadegh. The Dulles brothers then sold the new president on the idea of a coup by playing the communist card.
There's only one person in the whole Eisenhower administration who ever raises this question of Mossadegh's true beliefs, and that person was President Eisenhower himself. There was a meeting of the National Security Council at which Eisenhower said something like, "I'm glad we're overthrowing this communist, Mossadegh, but I actually wasn't aware that he really was a communist." And Dulles had a great answer. Dulles said, "Well, it's true that Mossadegh is not a communist. However, Mossadegh is an elderly man. He could die. He could be overthrown. That would produce instability in Iran. There is a communist party in Iran. Iran is on the border with the Soviet Union. Therefore, circumstances could unfold in a way that might leave Iran open to communism."
And then the straw that breaks the camel's back is the Soviets are coming. Where have we heard this before? The Soviets are coming, the Soviets are coming.
When Eisenhower heard that, he said, "Okay, you've convinced me."
And Eisenhower proves it, and it goes ahead. And there's one other thing operating here. Eisenhower has this incredible aversion for war. Not so counterintuitive if you think about it for a moment. He doesn't want to see a nuclear war in particular. And so he develops this penchant for clandestine operations because, compared to war, they're cheap.
After the Eisenhower administration made its decision to overthrow Mossadegh, Alan Dulles selected Kermit Roosevelt to carry out the coup. Kermit Roosevelt was the grandson of Theodore Roosevelt.
He's very well educated. My God, he's a Roosevelt. He is full of energy, the energy of youth, the dynamism of youth and good education, and he wants to serve his country, but he wants to do it in a secretive way. He wants to do it in an adventurous way. He wants to do it overseas and so forth.
As the chief of the Middle East section of the CIA, he was the logical choice.
So he's a perfect person for this kind of operation.
At the beginning of August 1953, Kermit Roosevelt arrived in Tehran and began this covert operation. It's really a fascinating operation to study because it answers this odd question: how do you overthrow a government? Suppose you get sent to a country and you're told, overthrow the government. So what do you do on the first day? What do you do on the second day? Kermit Roosevelt, who really was something like a true-life James Bond, carried out a very effective policy.
Roosevelt bribed tribal leaders and newspaper editors who now claim that Mossadegh was a dictator and had to go.
Every day they were printing articles about how evil Mossadegh was, that he was a Jew, he was a homosexual, he was a criminal, he was an agent of the British, anything they could think of to undermine him. One of the most interesting things that Kermit Roosevelt did, besides bribing members of parliament and military officers and everyone else, was his decision to throw Tehran into chaos. He had this idea that if there were riots and outbreaks of violence every day around Tehran, people would begin to think that Prime Minister Mossadegh had completely lost control of the country. So, as the coup day drew closer, he bribed the chief leader of the protection rackets in Tehran, a guy named Shaban the Brainless, to turn out his mob. It was Kermit Roosevelt's idea that this gang, this mob, should charge through the streets of Tehran, beat up pedestrians, break shop windows, fire guns into mosques, and then yell, "Up with communism, we love Mossadegh." And that wasn't even enough. Kermit Roosevelt had an even better idea. He hired another mob to attack that mob. That created a huge outbreak of street violence. The first idea that Kermit Roosevelt had was to bring the Shah into the plot.